started, I just want to mention, nobody asked me to do this, but I'm planning to go to Haiti for the spring holidays, and Chuck Smith is planning to go at the end of March to take, I think he purchased some of the equipment that's needed in the new building, the addition to the building that's going to be the church building. I think he's getting some of that here in the U.S. and taking it down. He's planning to do that at the end of March, just a few weeks away, a couple of weeks away. And then he plans to go down again in a couple of weeks after that for the dedication of the building. And what I'd appreciate your prayers is I just read yesterday or the day before, I guess it was the day before, that one of the opposition parties, one of the ones that's been instrumental in organizing protests, has called for a protest, another, stop the economy in its tracks protest, March 29th. I think March 29th is an anniversary of their constitution or something like that. So that's why they picked the date. Now, the people don't always heed the requests of this party, so I would just ask your prayers, and maybe they wouldn't this time. It just comes at a bad time, especially for the holy days. And it's not that it's necessarily dangerous. It's just that they disrupt the roads and traffic and just everything. And if somebody's there from another country, it's hard to get out. So hopefully, I don't want to have to deal with that. I'm sure Chuck doesn't either. So appreciate your prayers. Today's topic, from the last time I was here, and I believe everybody was here, so I'm going to recap, but I'll do it very, very quickly just to get us up to speed. And the topic is slavery as it's presented in the Bible. Interestingly enough, it's a very complex topic. Haiti, I think I mentioned this before, but Haiti was the first nation in the Western Hemisphere to outlaw slavery. And where to get them? They're as backwards as any other nation, maybe more backwards than any nation in the Western Hemisphere. So it's just it's a complicated thing. Really, what matters is honest and righteous government, which Haiti doesn't have, and really, I guess nobody has righteous government, but at least some governments in our world are less corrupt and care more for the people that they govern. We don't know. I don't know the truth about Haiti. I know that, for instance, there were, 5 Americans who were arrested with a great big cache of weapons and a couple of Central Asians. I forget what they were exactly. It might have been Ukrainians or something. And, these are ex-Navy SEALs and, people that are very talented. And they just kind of show up and they got caught because they didn't have a license plate. They had 3 sets of license plates in the vehicle. These are professional, come in, do some security, extra governmental security or whatever for somebody, but they got arrested. The poor police didn't know anything about them, and then Americans basically rescued them and took them back to the U.S. But why were they there? Nobody seems to know. There are indications that it could be the government, people in the government themselves, fearing for their own safety at the last time that the people shut the government, shut everything down, that those men and their families were concerned for their own safety and wanted some extra protection because they can't trust their own police or their own army. So it's just that's just the way it is. Now, I don't know if that's true. I don't know why they were there. But the fact is they were there for at somebody's request, and somebody was paying them. And our government must be aware of what's going on. And when the time came, they happened to have gotten caught for something, not for what they were there for, but for another reason. And somehow or another, we have the power just to go in and take them and bring them home. So it's a mess. The world's a mess, as we know. And we have brothers and sisters all over the world that are a subject to this kind of day-in and day-out reality. So don't forget them in your prayers. Okay. Maybe I can do it in 10 minutes. Let's just very briefly, since it was a couple of weeks ago, go through what we covered. And the end result today will be we'll go into the Bible, into the Old Testament and the New Testament, and look at pretty much all of the scriptures that deal with slavery, not to mention it offhand, but that deal with something or other having to do with slavery and how it's to be managed or so forth. The reason for this, or one of the reasons for this, was one is I got a question from a teenager who wanted to know And I, of course, had to do a lot of study, and I wasn't happy with all the information I was able to have on hand to study. But I've got books at home. I've got books by Hitchens and books by Dawkins and so forth. These, you know, militant atheists. Hitchens is dead now. Sam Harris, I don't have one of his books, but he's one of the ones that I quoted, you know, where they say, look, this book here that we honor and value and study supports slavery. And, you know, in our own history, in American Civil War, we had ministers on both sides, you know, southern, northern, whatever, on both sides of the conflict that used the Bible to support their point of view. If I can do a minor diversion, we're working on this a high-pressure job that's been really driving me crazy in downtown Frederick. It's a building that used to be part of a German Reformed church. And it's one of the oldest buildings in Frederick there. And it's been rebuilt. It was rebuilt around the time of the Civil War and been added on and whatever. And somebody that we work for is doing the work in a rehab, turning it into a bunch of going to be very high-priced apartments because of its location. What's interesting about this particular building is that in 1861, the Maryland legislature moved from Annapolis. I'm not sure why. Maybe I think the federal troops had occupied Annapolis. The Union troops had occupied Annapolis. You Pennsylvanians probably realize the Mason-Dixon line. Yeah, I grew up in Maryland. I thought we were Northern state only because we were occupied, not because we really had the heart to be a Northern state. But in Western Maryland, from where I live in Frederick and going west toward Hagerstown, was staunchly Unionist. Somewhat, you know, German and similar in makeup of people to what you're familiar with in Pennsylvania. But from Carroll County east and south, it was very much Southern mentality. And Baltimore was occupied during most of the war, so was Annapolis. Anyway, to catch up with the story, I believe that Annapolis was occupied. So the Maryland legislature met in this building in Frederick to consider secession. And they didn't secede. I don't know if they ever decided anything. And it was, you know, one of the complications was that all the people that were pro-secession were in a very hostile environment, Frederick being very staunchly Unionist or whatever you want to call it. So anyway, a little bit of my touch with Civil War history these past few weeks. So people are going to be living there. We're trying to change this all into apartments. But we were talking about the militant atheists, if you want to put it that way. They would accuse you and me of believing in a book that's actually immoral because it supports slavery. And everybody in the 21st century knows that slavery is immoral. Well, how do you answer that? So I wanted to look through the Bible and see how we answer that question. And I broke it into two sections, the first section being to get the background about slavery in the Old Testament, in the Bronze Age, and also up into the Roman and Roman Empire times, into Greek and Roman type of slavery. And we talked about just what slavery is and what the words mean. And that's important, too. And also took note of the fact that in your old Bibles, and if you have a King James 1611 version, that slavery, the word slave is only in there twice, and it's not really there either time. One time it has to do with the bodies and souls of men. The other time it's just not there at all. It's just added to into the Hebrew to make a Hebrew poem or Hebrew parallelism work. So the words that are now in modern translations translated slave weren't translated that way 400 years ago. Why? Well, because our attitudes have changed towards slavery and towards what we feel about it. And words like servant now have a connotation that's different. We don't call our maid a servant. We don't call a butler a servant. We don't call the person who comes and cleans the pool a servant. We don't call a person who mows your lawn a servant. But back, you know, 100 years ago, you did. So we have different usage of certain words in English, and that affects the way translators translate the book. So I have to keep that in mind. And it's interesting, at least to me, interesting, and I shared it with you, to go back and find out what the words meant. And we did that. We found that in the Old Testament, you have the word ebed in Hebrew, and it means basically a relationship where somebody works for somebody else. And I quoted Bob Dylan, who had a song, you know, everybody's got to serve somebody. And that's the way it was. And that's the way the world was in the Bronze Age. Everybody worked for somebody. You know, the king worked for God. Everybody else worked for the king. In one very general idea way of looking at it. And that was accepted, and that's the way the world worked. And there wasn't a negative connotation to that. You could have a good or a bad relationship with whoever it is you work for, just like you can now. But the fact is, everybody had to work. You didn't have too many independently wealthy people. You had a priestly class that lived off the people, and you had a government class that lived off the people. Everybody else was hand to mouth. So, excuse me. Okay. I'm going to get through this quickly. And the fact that somebody is an Eved was not necessarily negative. If you were a servant of the king and you were his right-hand man or right-hand woman, you were an Eved. That wasn't a negative thing. If you were Obadiah in the Bible, that meant an Eved, Obed, you're a servant of Yahweh, of Yah. That's what Obadiah means. So it's not negative to be a servant, not necessarily negative. What we have to be careful with, and you've been hearing this from me for years, that is, we don't want to what's the right word? I don't know what the word is. We don't want to project our modern ideas and modern sensibilities about certain subjects back onto the world of the Bible, because it was a different world. I'm not saying that this was a better world or worse world. That's not the point. The point is it was different. And so we can't think that the people back then were guided by the same mentality that we are now. And it's good to understand where they were coming from. When we look at slavery in the Old Testament, we saw that Abraham, for instance, was going to pass on his entire estate to a person you could term as a slave, somebody who was attached to his household, this Eliezer. He trusted Eliezer with money and gifts to go on a long journey to find a daughter in law. Now, you really have to trust somebody to do that. Here's somebody who's a quote-unquote slave that you're going to send away to pick a wife for your son. You don't even send your son, and you don't go yourself. You trust this guy. So it's different. When Lot was captured and Abraham was going to go free Lot and his family from the kings that had gone to war, he armed his slaves. These aren't people that don't want to be with him. You don't give them weapons. He armed several hundred of them to go after Lot and his family. So it's a different kind of slavery at that time. But that's the world of the Bible, at least as you begin reading with the patriarchs. The idea, but the Bible, all we're going to look at these scriptures, it has verses that have to do with how you need to treat slaves. And, Hammurabi had that in his code. There were codes that said, that tried to protect certain individuals that were that were vulnerable. The Bible does that too. Why were people slaves? They were slaves sometimes for debt, because they couldn't pay off a debt. They lost their land, perhaps. They had no way of growing food. So you'd hook yourself up with somebody who could provide for you, just like Naomi did with Ruth. Get Ruth hooked up with Obed, because this guy's going to have the means to take care of you and your family. So she wasn't a slave. In that sense, she became his wife, but sometimes marriages were arranged in a similar fashion because of debt or because of being in a situation where you can't take care of yourself. Your father, your mother, whatever, say, we need to sell you to this family. Well, it sounds horrible. You wouldn't want that to happen to you, but that's the way it was then. And it's still that way, as I mentioned, I think, last time. It's still that way in parts of the world today. Another main source of slavery, and this is especially true in the Roman Empire in that time of slavery, was POWs, prisoners of war. And typically it's because you've killed, and even in Israel it was that way, you've killed the males, and now you have the females and the children. And so that you take them into slavery, and you think, well, that's horrible. Well, what? I'm not saying it's not horrible, but you also have to think, on the other hand, what would these people do if you didn't provide for them somehow? I know you might think, well, slavery is not a great way to have to provide for them, and I give you, I'm kind of there too. But in that culture and at that time, the fact that you had an obligation to take care of them at least meant they were going to live and their kids could live. Whereas if they were left to starve, what good would that be? You know, they don't have anything to fall back on. They didn't have the safety net. And yes, there was a safety net in Israel called Third Tide, but that was for Israelites, not for prisoners of war. So you got to remember all those things. How was somebody, you know, they didn't have bankruptcy laws where you could, you know, discharge your debts now. You did have the seventh year release, you had the year of Jubilee, but sometimes you get in trouble in the seventh year, is not until, you know, 6 years away. So what are you going to do in the meantime? So you have to think about these things as you were the types of reasons that people got into a condition that we would call slavery. And you might lose your land. And if you lose your land because of some major debt, then how are you supposed to feed yourself? You know, that's a big problem. And I think I may have mentioned, but if I didn't, I've got friends from both Burma and Thailand who, to one degree or another, are slaves in South Korea. Now, are they really slaves? I wouldn't call them slaves. But they have, because of family debts, you know, they hook up with a broker, which amounts to, it's kind of like how the Central Americans come into the U.S. They pay a broker to get them up here. You pay this broker a little bit, or maybe you don't. Maybe you just got to give them a percentage of your income. I don't know how it works. And they'll get you, you know, they'll get you down to South Korea. And then you got a job. You get a good job. And you can send money home to your family. But it's not like you can, it's very difficult, put it this way. I don't know all the ins and outs and the details, but I know the one girl's been, or woman, she's been down there for many years. I don't know whether she can afford to leave. You know, first of all, your family gets used to the income. Secondly, it's not in the broker's interest to make it so that you become wealthy enough that you don't need it anymore. You don't need their services anymore. So you can, it can be a bit of a captivity in a way, and it's still around today. But they get that way. In one case, my friend Mopale, it's because his father died and had high medical bills and his mother got sick, you know, and he's the oldest son. So what's he do? He's got to pay the bill. And so he's working in South Korea. At least that's the last I heard. And that's one way to do it back over there. In Job 31, we looked at Job 31, and you know, we're reading through Job now. And Job was a righteous man, and God called him a righteous man. But this is good. I'm going to turn here. If I didn't turn before, I will. But even if I did, it's worth reading again. Because Job is defending himself oftentimes in the book, as we know. And he says in verse, what verse is it? I'll write it down. Job 31, but now I can't get my eye on the verse. That's because I turned the page. Verse 13, he says, "If I did despise the cause of my manservant or my maidservant," I'm reading from the King James, that means your male or female slave, "when they contended with me, what then shall I do when God rises up and when he visits? And when, how shall I answer him? Didn't he who made me in the womb make him?" How about that? You know, we're of one fashion. We're one flesh, in a sense. Job recognized that he had to actually listen to his slaves complain to him because they're fellow human beings. They were in a different economic status, you know, but he was to treat them well. And if he didn't, he'd have God to answer to. So slavery, again, back in those days, was supposed to be different. And it was different. And it had there was a different understanding that went with it. Okay. You know, and we mentioned, and Justin helped me out with the name of the act, but, you know, in the Civil War, or in time before the Civil War in America, we were trying to define what the life of a slave is worth. And here Job is saying, you know, we're the same. We have the same value. It's not like in Nazi Germany where, you know, the Jews had zero. They were worth zero. They were animals. You know, or in America where there were three-fifths of a person or whatever. You know, those kinds of ridiculous equations. Then we looked at the Exodus briefly. Notice that the Bible does not even express, I always thought it did, somehow that the Israelites are being freed, like they're going to gain their freedom. No, they went from being servants of Pharaoh, as Tammy pointed out, to being servants of God. They were still Eved. They just had a different boss. And God purchased them for his own use and his own purposes. And the Bible, in the book of Exodus, only refers to the Israelites as Eved in one chapter. I think it was Exodus 15, if I remember. I wrote it down. Yeah, Exodus 5, I'm sorry, verses 15 and 16. But it refers to servants of Pharaoh many, many, many times. Evet. So it's not necessarily a negative thing. It's just who you're working for. Who you're working for. Israelites were bought to be servants of God and slaves, if you want to put it that way, belonging to him. Everybody had to work for somebody, so Israelites went from working for Pharaoh to working for God. Did they have to build treasure cities for God? No. That's, you know, and somebody brought that up when I gave this in another location. So, well, you know, she had a hard time working with the thought, and as I guess it came out that way when I said it, that God was just transferring ownership. So they're slaves of one to being slaves of his. Well, yes and no. I mean, they weren't being abused by God, but in that culture, just understand, everybody works for somebody. So instead of working for Pharaoh, they were working for God. And, you know, King Solomon himself, when I think I referred to this, but it's 1 Kings 5 and verse 13 to 15, if you want to look it up. But he had work parties, and they weren't just take a Sunday and go up and help, you know, build the feast site. It was, you know, they went for months at a time or however long they went, and they went and they had groups of, there were three different flights of them. So you'd go and you'd serve, and you know, I don't know how much they got paid, if they got paid. I don't know what the deal was, but it was forced labor. And it wasn't foreigners and it wasn't slaves, it was citizens. It was Israelites that were being forced to work by their own king. And it's just the way it was. And I'm sure that in Egypt, there were Egyptians being forced to work by the Pharaoh. But they weren't slaves in the same sense. They weren't foreigners. They were just local people. You know, the priests had the freedom. The priests had the rights. But as we looked, when we were looking at the book of Exodus, we saw, while we referred back to the book of Genesis, where Joseph, because of saving all the goods, the people of Egypt sold their land. They sold their animals. They sold everything. They sold everything and finally themselves said, we work for Pharaoh. I don't know that they didn't work for Pharaoh before, but now it was official. So by the time the Israelites come along and, you know, the time of the Exodus, the Egyptians are, in a sense, a property of the Pharaoh. And that's not unusual. That's the way it was everywhere. And I made the point, and I'd like to get this, you know, make sure it's in your mind when we talk about slavery, the concept of freedom that we have today is a very modern concept. Nobody throughout history, no complete culture. I mean, maybe the rich and famous sometimes, but no culture has had what we have in the modern times in America and in other countries, where you have the freedom to just come and go, do what you want, move. It hasn't historically been possible. It hasn't been economically possible. So we don't, again, want to put our ideas of what freedom means to us, that we highly value freedom as Americans, we don't want to put that idea back onto the Bible because it didn't exist back then. It just didn't exist. There was considerable freedom in the Roman Empire compared to other cultures. You know, Paul could take a journey, go to different places. There was that Pax Romana. You know, but it still wasn't, you know, if you were a slave, you know, like Jesus, not a slave, a non-citizen, you'd be crucified for a supposed fault or whatever. And even the Roman citizen, although they had certain rights, they didn't have the same freedoms we have today. So I'm leaving the Exodus behind us, going to the New Testament times, Greco-Roman slavery. It was a lot more brutal than what we read about in times of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, or the times of Israel and Egypt. In the Roman Empire, if you were not educated and you didn't have much to offer, you'd find yourself in a salt mine, and you'd be digging the salt, and if you die, you die. If you live, you live. They didn't care much. They'd replace you, and it could be a very horrible living. If you were smart, if you had been educated wherever, you know, country that you came from when you were taken as a prisoner of war, if you were smart and you got good jobs, you're like, you know, Joseph, who worked for Potiphar and rose to the top. That was certainly a possibility, and a lot of people enjoyed that and were able to eventually run their own businesses, run their master's business, maybe run their own business, start their own business on the side, purchase their own freedom. You remember the commander that when Paul was about ready to get stoned by his own people, and the Roman guy, at the fort there on the temple, started taking him up the stairs to keep him from getting hurt, and he was going to beat him at some point. They were going to that's what you do to people to get the truth out of them. You start flogging them or something. And Paul says, "You're going to beat me? I'm a Roman citizen." And what did the guy say? The guy said, "Oh, I too am a Roman citizen. It cost me a lot of money. How about you?" And, Paul was freeborn. He was from Tarsus, which was a city where everybody was a citizen. But you could gain your citizenship, as that commander did. And it's still, again, we have our own system here. I just try to broaden your horizons a little bit. I think I've mentioned this before. I got this friend in Thailand who's from the hill country. He's not, if you're from the hill country, if you're in the boonies, between Thailand and Burma, if you're a Karen or one of the other tribes, you are not born a citizen just because you're born in Thailand. And he wasn't born a citizen. And one year I went there and, he had one name. And the next year I went there, he had another name. I said, "What happened?" Well, he's getting his citizenship. His parents, basically mortgaged the farm, sold what they could, whatever, got a whole pile of money together to buy him his citizenship. And then they changed his name so you can't automatically tell that he is from up in the hills. So he's got now a Thai name, because Thai is a different tribe and whatever. And I guess I don't know enough about the culture to know. I guess he doesn't look so much like the people that he comes from that people could tell. But at least on the application form, he's got a Thai name now, and he's a Thai citizen, so he can get a good job. So it's still that way in many parts of the world. The New Testament, we'll talk about this a little bit, but you got to remember also that the New Testament itself is a product of the Roman Empire of that time, and so it's written from that perspective. And you and I might wish that Paul just wrote a letter and said, free all your slaves, because slavery is something we don't approve of in the church. But you know what? If he'd have done that, he'd have gotten in trouble, number one. But number two, they couldn't really do that. You were limited to how many slaves you could release. You had 10, you could only release 3. If you had 3, you could only release 1. There were rules, I guess, to try to keep there from being too many slaves that were free. They could, work against the government. I don't know what the reasons were. But there were limits. So you couldn't do what you couldn't do, what was illegal. Paul uses influence. He wanted Onesimus to be free and to serve in the church. And so he talked finally, he kind of strong-armed Philemon a little bit, talked him into it. But that shows how he felt about slavery. But Paul uses the imagery of slavery, of Roman slavery, to explain the concepts of Christians being servants and slaves of God. Because in that age, it would have been you serve sin or you serve God or you serve the emperor or you serve Christ, however you want to look at it. Then we looked at the, I'm doing it in a slightly different order. We looked at the law and how, not at the law in particular, but how we should view the law. And we talked about how the law should be understood as a guideline, as principles. It doesn't give you details of every single situation. There are modern challenges, and even in the Bible, there were challenges that weren't covered specifically by Torah, but then you use the principles in Torah to come to a judgment. The law was intended as a source of wisdom for the judges, and was at times to even provide a particular bias. And we'll talk about that. I won't get into it again. So that the judges would tend to lean a certain way rather than another way, just give a reason why. It doesn't tell you what to necessarily rule in a given situation, but it's telling you, it makes sense to look at it from this direction rather than this direction. And that's in the Torah. The law was specific for Israel. It's concerned for Israelites. It was concerned for the children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It involved other people as they came into contact with Israel. It wasn't a blueprint for world peace. It wasn't telling you how all international relationships or work. It wasn't about all that. It was how to live in your own society in a godly way. At the same time, the law at times regulated things, managed things, however you want to put it, that God does not necessarily approve of. And we talked about war, we talked about polygamy, we talked about divorce, we talked about revenge, like Lex Talionis. And, I'm including in there slavery. I'm saying, the law regulates slavery. That doesn't mean God approved of it any more than God approves of polygamy or divorce or war or revenge killings. But because that's the way the world was, because people were going to do a certain way, the law of Israel had ways of mitigating the abuses that could happen as a result of those things. Okay. Now let's move on. That's a little longer than I intended. Let's start in Exodus 21. That's the biggest, one of the biggest sections. And it's one that people like to quote from. I don't know what to make of it, and I didn't say this before when I've talked about this, but it's also at the very beginning of the law, you know, as it follows the Ten Commandments there. One of the first things it gets into is this is the treatment of slaves. What we're supposed to gather from that, I don't know. But I think it's interesting anyway. Exodus 21, we're going to start with verses 1 to 11. These are the judgments which you shall set before them if you buy a Hebrew servant. Here you go. Here's the judgments. You start with buying a Hebrew servant. If you buy one of your brothers, 6 years he will serve, and on the seventh year he shall go out free for nothing. So the idea of having your own brothers or sisters as permanent slaves is debunked right from the beginning. You can't do that. So it sounds like, well, some people say, well, the Bible's approving of slavery. You can look at it that way. I don't agree with that, but I would look at it as like, you know, slavery is a situation that occurred in that world on a very common and very normal basis in most societies. And the Bible, one of the first things it says in the law is, you're only going to get six or seven years. You got to let him go. So and he doesn't doesn't cost him anything. So it's a proactive rule that actually looks out for the life of the slave. Also, I need to point out, I don't think I mentioned this before, but the word buy there doesn't necessarily mean buy for money. You think, well, is that a picky thing? Well, not really, because it actually just means acquire or get. You can get them all kinds of ways. You don't have to buy a servant. The servant could owe you a whole bunch of money that's several years' salary for whatever reason and has no way of paying it. You know, so you didn't buy him in literally, but in order to work off his debt, he's going to come work for you for a while. And it doesn't, when you see that word buy, a lot of times, at least in Hebrew, it doesn't literally mean that there was an exchange of money. It means that you acquired in one way or another this a person or a goods or whatever. Verse 3, if he came in by himself, he will go out by himself. If he were married, then his wife will go out with him.
Let's
go to chapter 22. Just wanted to see one thing to give you an example. Exodus 22 and verse 2 says, if a thief is found breaking up and he's smitten and he died, no blood shall be shed, but if sun be risen upon him, there shall be blood set for him, for he should make full restitution. Full restitution. If he has nothing, he shall be sold for his theft. So there's a way, just to get back here into chapter 21, there's one way you could end up being a slave. Actually being sold, you're a thief, and you have to work your thievery off. You have to make it good. And you can think what you want about that, but you know, what do we do now? We put somebody in jail, and they have no hope of repaying you. You know, the judges, they'll get, say, so-and-so's in there, he's got to pay a million-dollar fine. Well, unless you're rich, whatever. A lot of times, fines are pie in the sky. This individual's never going to be able to pay that fine. And plus, we support them while they're in prison. So not only do they not pay society back, we pay them. And people think the Bible is so backwards, but doesn't this make sense? Somebody steals and he has to pay it back. And if he doesn't have the money, he can go to work for whoever he's got to pay back. And then he or she is paying back society, and we don't all have to pay them. So kind of makes sense to me. How you would administer that takes wise judges, but anyway. Thief can be productive and recompense society, and it doesn't cost society anything. So I think that's pretty forward-looking. All right, now we continue. If he came in by himself, he goes out by himself, he's married, his wife shall go out with him. If his master has given him a wife, and she has borne him sons or daughters, his wife and his children shall be her master's, and he shall go out by himself. That sounds kind of, you might think it sounds unfair. You can take issue with it. But there's, again, several things to think about. What's the point behind that? I'm not sure, but here's what I think. Anybody got an idea? Why would that be? I mean, it could be several reasons. First of all, it says right here that his master provided for them. But anybody, why would it be like he doesn't get to leave with everybody that his master gave him? One thing that came to my mind, not just that the master is the one who's provided this wife and then by essence in the children as well, but he supported them. So he's got a monetary investment there. But also, how if you free a slave today, how is it that he's going to support himself? Maybe he can, maybe he can't. But it might be difficult. But then if you free him and five kids and a wife, how's he going to support them starting tomorrow? Now, that's just me thinking. It's just my own reasoning. So perhaps part of the reasoning behind this is to make it more likely that everybody gets taken care of. Again, everybody's going to work for somebody. So he's going to have to find another situation where he can, you know, somehow or another provide for himself, provide for whoever's with him. Notice in verse 5 it says, if the servant plainly says, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I won't go out free. Master bring, you know, pierces his ear, and that's a sign that, you know, I'm going to be a permanent permanent slave. Now, are you volunteering to do that because you're going to live in a horrible situation? No. You're volunteering to do that because, all right, let's take some examples. I don't know what these examples are. I'm going to make up some. You broke your hip or something, and you can only do certain things because it never healed right. So you're limping around, and your master is okay with that. He knows that you have certain limitations, and he gives you kind of jobs you can handle. He's very good to you, and he takes care of you, and he takes care of your family. But if you don't have that, then you're on your own. You got to go out and make your own living. You can't work the farms because that's too hard. Maybe your family doesn't have any land. You make up any number of scenarios here. And you might say, you know what, I've got it pretty good here. This guy cares for me. His wife's pretty good. His kids, I get along with everybody. This is as good of a deal as I can get or as I can expect. Why would I want to do something else? Why do I want to be quote-unquote free? Well, he wasn't thinking about free because, you know, again, their concept of freedom is very different than ours. But he wasn't, you know, what he's looking for is, can I eat? Do I have a place to sleep? Can my family eat? Do they have a place to sleep? And if that's provided by working here, what's the difference whether I work for this guy and officially I'm a slave, or I go here and I find some, you know, somehow I can grow my own food, but I can't because I'm injured. You know, in other words, there's a lot to think about here. And I think that the laws in the Torah are there to protect the vulnerable. And this guy might be vulnerable, or maybe he wouldn't stay. Or maybe he's just got it so good, loves his master. It's like, you know, I'll stick here. It's better than I can expect somewhere else. Why would I want to go anywhere else? So I'll be a slave forever. Sounds horrible to us because of our modern concept of what slavery has been in North America. But it wasn't that way there. It wasn't supposed to be that way anyway. And again, don't think that everything that we read here is the be-all and the end-all and the final decision on every case that may seem to fit in there. The purpose of these laws is to give the judges wisdom and how to apply to the how to apply God's law to specific situations, specific circumstances. So these things don't cover every single circumstance, but they give you some broad guidelines. And here's a case of where maybe someone has the right to be freed, but he doesn't want to be, and the law says, you know, we can do it that way. That's good. You know, there's a way to be free. You know, it doesn't have to go free in the seventh year. If he wants to stay, he can stay. But it's his choice. Okay. I want to go to Deuteronomy 15 before I continue. Deuteronomy chapter 15, beginning in verse 12. This is more talk about the year of release. And so you got to get to the judges had, theoretically anyway, had access to all of these, and they could take from each section of the law the things that might apply to the situation and help them to come to a wise decision. Okay, verse 12 of Deuteronomy 15. If your brother, a Hebrew man or a Hebrew woman, be sold to you and serve you 6 years, in the seventh year you shall let him go free. And when you send him out free, you won't let him go away empty. Oh, here we go. That's something you don't find in Exodus 21, but look what it says here. Not only does he not owe you anything when you let him go, but you better give him something to help him get started. Doesn't sound that terrible, does it, in that sense? It's a positive thing. Verse 14, furnish him literally out of your flock, out of your floor, out of your winepress, of that which is God's blessed you, you shall give to him, and remember that you were a bondman in the land of Egypt, and the Lord God redeemed you, and therefore I command you this thing this day. And if he says to you, I don't want to go away because he loves you in your house, because it's well, he's happy to be there, then you shall take an awl and thrust it through. Again, you're going to pierce his ear, and that's the symbol that he'll work for you permanently. And it won't seem hard to you when you send him away from you, for he has been worth double a hired servant to you in serving you for 6 years, and God will bless you. So the point being is that you need to not just let him go and maybe hope that he can't function and manage on his own, so he'll come begging you back for his job and let you pierce his ear with an awl. No, you need to supply him from, he's worked for you for 6 years, or maybe for some period of 1 to 6, whatever. He's worked for you for less than the going rate, and because of that, you owe him something when you let him go. You owe him out of your flock, out of your herd, or whatever. He's helped you to build that. You give him something so he can get off to a good start and provide for himself and maybe a family. So that's, very different from the kind of slavery that we had in North America. It's not slavery in the same sense. Again, you think, well, who would want to be a slave forever? Well, it's better than starving. Again, maybe you have a mental problem. Not just like I was saying, the hip, you can't work. Maybe you've got a mental problem. We have all kinds of safety nets. I've had employees and children with certain problems, right? And There are programs out there where these children, and now they're adults, are able to get jobs and function in society. Didn't have that then. Well, you did have it, but it was the resource. The way that happened was not through some governmental agency. It was through people of means that were expected to help take care of the others. All right, back to Exodus 21, and we'll pick it up in verse 7. If a man sell his daughter to be a maidservant, then she shall not go out as the men servants do. If she pleases not her master who has betrothed her to himself, he shall let her be redeemed and sell her. He will have no power to sell her to a strange nation, seeing he has dealt deceitfully with her. Okay? So here's an example. You think, well, you can sell, quote unquote, a girl into slavery. But the idea here is that all marriages were arranged, right? That's the way it was. Parents would arrange the marriage. So here's a case where you're arranging a marriage with your daughter who's not even of age to be married yet. She's going to go and be this person's quote-unquote slave. We call it slavery, but it was just a deal there. We're going to, this guy's well off. It's a Boaz, right? It's a Boaz. We're going to be hooked up with him because he's got land and he's got people working for him, and he's going to take care of people in our family. So our daughter, we're going to promise her to him. Okay? And then it says here that if he doesn't marry her and doesn't take care of her, he can't just keep her as a slave. He's got to let her be redeemed. He's got to let the family get her back. So again, this is protection. These laws are written to protect somebody who would be vulnerable. And who's vulnerable here? It's the girl. It's the young girl, because she doesn't have rights. In that patriarchal society, she doesn't have rights. But the law here gives her some rights, or gives her family some rights, to buy her back and so forth if the marriage doesn't work out and the guy decides he doesn't want her. Do you want to go to verse 9? I think so. If he has betrothed her unto his son, he shall deal with her after the manner of daughters. So again, it could be you sold him to this family, not for him, but for his son. So again, she has to; they have to take her as a wife and treat her as a wife. If he take him another wife, her food, her raiment, and her duty of marriage shall he not diminish. And this is polygamy. It can have more than one wife, but you can't just say, I don't really want you, I'm not going to take care of you. The law is saying, no, you can't do that. And if that's the way you feel, you let her go back to her family. You can be compensated some for it, but you let her go back. If he doesn't do these three unto her, then she shall go out free without money. So if he won't even take care of her at all, she doesn't even have to be redeemed. He has to allow her to be redeemed if he doesn't want to marry her. But maybe the family doesn't even have the money to redeem her. But if he doesn't want to at least provide for her, whether or not he wants to marry her, if he's not going to provide for her or his son's not going to provide for her, she gets to go for free. She doesn't even have to be redeemed. So again, these laws are protecting the vulnerable people in society. Verse 16, we skip down because these other things are not about slavery. Verse 16 says, he that steals a man and sells him, or if he's found in his hand, he shall surely be put to death. So kidnapping is against the law. So is slave trafficking. It's against the law. So you can't very well have what we had in North America, right? No, the North American slavery. You can't have that if this law was obeyed. You just wouldn't have it. It seems to include both the kidnapper and the slave trader. But if we look at Deuteronomy 24, verse 7, I'll just look there. Deuteronomy 24, verse 7, it's not clear. Because sometimes there's laws that don't apply to foreigners. So the judges had to figure all this out. Verse 7 says, if a man be found stealing any of his brethren of the children of Israel and makes merchandise of him or sells him, that thief shall die. He put away evil from among you. So was it only for when you selling for being a slave trader in your own people, or did it apply to foreigners? I guess the judges will have to figure that out. I can't say that I'm 100% clear on that. Now we have an interesting thing back in chapter 21. I should have told you to stay there. And these are the kind of things that people look at and say, this is immoral. Not just slavery itself, but some of the verses here. Look at verse 20, because it has some other points in there, and then we get back to servants. Verse 20 says, if a man smites his servant or his maid with a rod, and he die under his hand, he shall surely be punished. Notwithstanding, if he continues a day or two, he shall not be punished, for he is his money. So it sounds like, this is what people would say, you beat him and he dies, he's going to be punished. If you beat him and he doesn't, you beat him to within an inch of his life and he lives, you're okay. Is that what it's saying? I don't think so. I don't think so. You need to look at it in a little more detail, and let's also go down to a couple of other verses. Notice verse 26. There's something in between that's not specifically dealing with servants. If a man smite the eye of his servant, oh, by the way, I should interrupt and say, just to remind you that, in my opinion, when you read this word eved in the Old Testament, we should consider it servant, because everybody serves somebody. You read slave, a lot of times slave or doulos in the New Testament, it's better understood as slave. In the Roman Empire, slavery is slavery more like we picture it. In the Bronze Age, slavery is not how we picture it. Saying the word servant might be better for us to understand what was going on. So, verse 26 says, if a man smite the eye of his servant, or the eye of his maid, that it perish, he shall let him go free for his eye's sake. And if he smite his manservant's tooth, or his maidservant's tooth, he shall let him go free for his tooth's sake. Okay, so if we combine verse 26 and 27 with verses 20 and 21, then we would conclude that if you injure your servant's eye, you have to free them. If you injure your servant's tooth, You have to free him. If you beat him to within 1 inch of his life, but he lives, nothing happens. Does that make sense? Well, it doesn't make sense to me. So you got to put it all together, and the judges would put it all together. So what is the point, then, of verse 20 and 21? It's one of these cases, I would say, and others would say, of giving the judges a bias. And that is, you know, if somebody hit, and it did happen, I'm not saying this is good or bad, I would think it's bad. It would happen that somebody would beat their servant for whatever the reason. The judge is being advised here, don't assume that the guy wants to kill his own servant. Because, why? Because it says in the King James, he is his money. That word is silver. No, and it doesn't mean that he bought him. It means that the servant is earning money or earning a living to one extent or another for his boss, for his master. So this is advice to the judges to think, don't automatically assume that somebody's out to kill their own servant because it doesn't make sense. And to think that somehow you can beat them to within an inch of their life and be off scot-free, but just hurting their tooth or hurting their eye means you got to set them free, that doesn't make sense. You got to put it all together. And not just take, as critics of the Bible will do, take that one verse out of there and say, look, you can all but kill a guy and you get off free. No, that's not what it's saying. And certainly verse 26 and verse 27 would make no sense at all if that's what verse 20 and 21 meant. They didn't have money. You know, they weren't minting money. So to say it's a silver is not, it's, you know, it wasn't like I paid cash for this. No, that's not what it means. It means he's earning you. He's earning for you. Okay, Deuteronomy 20. That's all we have in chapter 21. Let's go to Deuteronomy again. And chapter 20, verse 10. And here we're talking, it's some rules having to do with war. And again, I claim that God is not in favor of war in this sense, that is that people should go to war. But knowing that that's what's going to happen, that you're going to go or people are going to come and war against you, God made rules for it and how you should handle it. Well, here's what's in Deuteronomy. When you come nigh, verse 10, unto a city to fight against it, proclaim peace. In other words, you know, you don't have to automatically just kill everybody. This is talking about people that are not in the land. And proclaim peace. And it will be, if to make an answer of peace, then open unto you, it shall be that all the people that's found therein shall be tributaries to you. So they have to pay. You know, they have to pay tribute. And it will make, if they don't make peace, and but no make war, then you can besiege it. And when the Lord your God has delivered it into your hands, you smite every male with the edge of the sword, but the women and the little ones and the cattle and all that's in the city, even the spoil thereof, shall take to yourself, and you shall eat the spoil of your enemies, and the Lord your God has given to you. And this is what you should do for all the cities which are very far from you, which are not the cities of the nations, but the cities of these people. So that's the rule for people outside the land. The rule for people inside the land was that they were to get rid of the people inside the land. That's the way the Torah reads. So this is one way that foreigners became slaves, because if they would give in and say we surrender, then they had to pay tribute. They weren't necessarily slaves. They still had quote unquote freedom, if you want to call it that. But if they fought you and you beat them and you killed their males, then the females, you know, the rest become your slaves. So this is one way it could happen, and one way it did happen. Now, how did you take, you know, how were those people to be taken care of? Well, they became your slaves. In other words, they became part of your households, and you had the obligation to take care of them. If you wanted the work that they could provide and the help for your family, then you had to provide for them. They had to eat. Because there's no safety net in Jericho after the walls fell down. For instance, Jericho is a bad example because it's in the land there, or right on the other side of the river. But just for argument's sake, you know, if you've destroyed a city, then what do the women and children do? They starve, or they gotta, you know, they go somewhere else, and the women have to become prostitutes in order to support themselves, or whatever. You know, so the Bible gives a way for these people to be provided for. Chapter 23. Chapter 23, verse 15. Interesting verse here. I think I might have mentioned it last time. You shall, Deuteronomy 23, verse 15. You shall not deliver unto his master the servant which is escaped from his master unto you. He shall dwell with you, even among you, in that place which he shall choose. The place that he shall choose. In one of your gates, where it likes him best. And don't oppress him. So here's, if slavery is the official, like this is the way it's going to be, you know, how was it in America? You could not. You know, you had to, let's put it this way, you weren't supposed to help an escaped slave. You're supposed to send them back. In the Roman Empire, you had to send them back, or you'd be in big trouble. What did Paul do with Onesimus, or Onesimus, however you would say his name? He pleaded with Philemon to free him, right? But he sent him back. He sent Onesimus back with the letter, right? Isn't that how it worked? I didn't look it up, but the point being that Paul, by law, had to return the escaped slave. But then he begged the master, Philemon, to free him. So in the Roman Empire, you could be prosecuted for not returning an escaped slave. But in the Torah, you did not return an escaped slave. So what's that telling us? That tells us another thing. That, again, this institution of slavery that we think is so horrible, and I'm not defending it, the slavery we had in North America was a horrible thing. And the slavery in the Roman Empire was oftentimes a horrible thing. And slavery in other parts of the world, even today, a horrible thing. But in the eyes of the Torah, you had situations where working in these kinds of arrangements was maybe the best deal that you could find. And it wasn't so bad. You know, many of us in America are slaves to our job to one degree or another. We can't detach from the system, you know. Without the mark of the beast, whatever that mark is, you know, you can't buy, sell, whatever. You know, there's something about society that you, unless you decide to totally unplug, which very, very few people do and are successful at, and grow your own food, you're somehow tied in. So we don't really have the freedom sometimes that we think we might have. Well, back then, you know, they had even less. But it wasn't so bad. As long as you could eat, as long as you had a place to sleep, it wasn't a negative thing. And it was assumed that in most cases, it was a good deal. And if it wasn't a good deal, and you ran away, and you showed up in this town and said, I ran away from my master, boy, was it horrible, he did this, he did that. You are to offer this guy a place to, you know, he could say, you can stay here. You'll be good. You can make your living here. That's what the Torah is telling him. So the assumption then is that masters are good to their slaves, if we want to call them slaves, to their servants. And if they're not, the servants can run away and they have to be provided refuge elsewhere. That's a very different idea than North American slavery or than Roman slavery. Okay, so when we go back to the Iron Age, we got to think like Iron Age people, if that's helpful. We don't want to think like Romans, or we don't want to think like 21st century Americans. So I think that's a really telling scripture to me. You know, if somebody escaped, the judges were told, this is all advice to judges, right? The judges are told, assume that person had a good reason to leave. And make sure if they show up in your town, and, you know, at your city gates that you provide for them and let them live where they want to live. That's certainly very different than any slavery that we've heard about in modern times. Leviticus 25, that's the other chapter that has a lot, and I'm saving it for last because it has a verse that has a few verses that I'm not going to explain very well because I don't have an answer, but they're there. Leviticus 25, let's start in verse 39. If your brother that dwells by you be waxed poor and sold to you, you shall not compel him to serve as a bondservant, but as a hired servant. So that's different, right? There's a difference between that kind of slavery, some harsh slavery, and just working as basically an employee, but a live-in employee that you're providing for. You know, like your butler or your maid or, you know, in the old days. Could be like that. Like Hazel. Remember, some of us are the age we can remember Hazel, the sitcom on TV. You know, 50 years ago, that didn't seem all that unusual. Nowadays, you'd have a hard time with a show like that, probably. Well, that's what the Torah is saying here. You know, you should treat them like they treated Hazel. You need to be like, what's this, Mr. B? But as a hired servant and a sojourner shall he be with you, and he shall serve you to the year of Jubilee. And then he shall depart from you, both he and his children from him, and is returned to his own family and to his own possession. So a lot of times the debt is a result of having lost one's land, one's family land. And if you lose your inheritance, then you don't. Where do you grow your food? How do you provide for yourself? Well, you have to have a job to provide for yourself. If you don't have land, where do you get a job? Well, sometimes you just sold yourself into slavery. In other words, you got a job. You filled an application. Go to Dan. Say, Dan, you need some help with computers. Yeah, okay. Well, I can help you, but I need you to feed me, and I need a place for my wife and kids to stay. Okay, we got a deal. And that's how it worked. That's how it worked. At least that's how it was supposed to work. I can't say it always worked that way, but that was the ideal. So we have poor countrymen for whatever reason. Now, why should you think about that? And why should you look at it this way? Because you are my servants, which I brought forth out of the land of Egypt, verse 42. They shall not be sold as bondmen. So you couldn't sell them. You can sell them to other rich people when you're done with them. That's not the way it worked. That's with people in the land, your own brothers and sisters. Verse 43, and you shall not rule over him with rigor, but shall fear your God. In other words, be a good master, be a good employer. Of course, we gain wisdom from the Bible on how we treat our employees, if we have employees or people that work for us. And the context here is not employees like we have now. That just didn't really exist in the same way back then. But we learn from this relationship, the eved, between the servants and their masters. In verse 44, both your bondmen and your bondmaids, which you shall have, which of the heathen around about you, of them you may buy bondmen or bondmaids. And again, buy doesn't necessarily mean buy with money. It means you can acquire them. Moreover, the children of your strangers that do sojourn with you, and of them you shall buy, or you can get, and of their families that are with you, they shall be your possession. And, gets worse, verse 46, you shall take them for an inheritance for your children after you to inherit them for a possession. They shall be your bondmen forever. But over your children, or the brethren, I'm sorry, the children of Israel, you shall not serve over one another with rigor. So, I don't have a good answer for this. I'd like to think, well, we oughtn't do that. We don't do it in our modern society anyway. And again, I don't think the Bible was approving of it, saying this is what you ought to do. It's just regulating a practice. And I'll just have to say I don't understand why they couldn't be freed like the others. But that's my modern 21st century whatever ideas, and I'm not there then, and I'm not speaking for God. I'm just saying I just don't fully understand that, but it's there. Most of these people, again, were acquired because of war, and because they had to be provided for, the women and children, and so you did that. And I assume that part of the rationale here is because you took them on, you get work for them, but then you also had to provide for them, and you provide for the families as they're growing up. You've got an investment there, and you're able to gain on the investment in that sense. And again, the law was made for Israel, not for all the nations. It was Israel. But notice this, and if we continue on down, verse 47, and if a sojourner or a stranger wax rich by you, so foreigners were, it was understood that a foreigner could do well. And notice what it says in verse 47, and your brother that dwells with him wax poor and sell himself unto the stranger, a sojourner, or to the stock of the stranger's family, him that is sold may be redeemed again. In other words, it could actually be that the stranger among you gets richer than you, and you may have to sell yourself into service to them. And the law saying, if that's the case, fine, but your family has the right to redeem you, buy you back. You're not stuck there forever. So, anyway, I saved that one for last. I don't claim to have a good explanation. Maybe you do. But in that sense, in that one verse, foreigners, which we would assume became in that state of servants, permanent servants, because they were prisoners of war or children and wives of prisoners of people that were killed in war. That was the one example of some kind of permanent arrangement, permanent slavery, that could be actually inherited. So there it is. And I don't, other than the fact that they somehow were provided for, for the long term, not just, you know, this year or next year, but over the long haul. And it was certainly a deterrent, I guess, to, I shouldn't say it was, you know, if you're fighting a war, I need to take that back. It's not a deterrent. I don't have a good explanation for that, and I'll just leave it at that. Now, New Testament. I don't have much time, but we don't have many scriptures, so it's okay. As I said, Christians could not change the legal system. It was a different world. The Roman and Greek world was very different than the Bronze Age world of the Exodus and of Israel. And you couldn't just, as I said, the ministers of the church, the apostles, whoever, couldn't just say, free all your slaves. You can't do that. Couldn't do that. It was against the law. It would get everybody killed. So, or prosecuted if they were citizens. So that wasn't going to work. 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 10. We notice here kind of people that are included among those that are called disobedient. 1 Peter 1 and verse 10. I'm sorry, 1 Timothy 1 and verse 10. And it lists whoremongers and them that defile themselves with mankind and men stealers. These are disobedient. It's a whole list of people that are disobedient. Men stealers. That is the only time this word's used in the Bible. It's, what is it? Andropodiste. And it's a word that means a man stealer, you know, or a man, you know, trafficker in men, whatever. And from andro, like andro, you know, something having to do with men or humans, and a word for the word meant this is a word for men stealers, but it's referring to captives. There were two words in Greek in the Roman Empire for slaves. One of them was this andropodiste, which had to do with slaves that were captives of war, and then the other word doulos that we're familiar with in the Bible is a word that has to do with bond slaves. So they're both are bond slaves in a sense, but one had, the derivation is that one is more specifically tied to a prisoner of war. I believe that doulos should be translated slave in our modern understanding, and that's a good way to read it, and most modern translations of the New Testament do that. Excuse me. So if people that are slave traders are automatically included among the disobedient, that's a pretty good indication that the Bible doesn't approve, at least by the time we get to the New Testament, does not approve or promote slavery. Because you can't have slavery without having a slave trade. And it's saying if you're a slave trader, you're disobedient. So that and the book of Philemon are really indication enough that, you know, come Jesus, come the Holy Spirit, come the New Testament, and the understanding of, you know, turning the other cheek and all these things that we, you know, Jesus said, we always thought it was this way, but here's the way it really was from the beginning. Slavery doesn't fit. Slavery doesn't fit in with it. 1 Timothy chapter 6, while we're in 1 Timothy, verses 1 and 2. Again, this wasn't the time and place to change the system. They couldn't do it. Legally, they couldn't do it, but we can do the best we can in whatever circumstance we find ourselves. Verse 1 of chapter 6 says, "Let as many as are servants that are under the yoke count their own masters worthy of all honor, that the name of God and his doctrine not be blasphemed. And they that have believing masters, let them not despise them because they are brethren, but rather do them service because they are faithful and beloved, partakers of the benefit. These things teach and exhort." Is it possible that you take advantage of a relationship with somebody else who's in the church? Yes. Maybe some of you have experienced that. I have been an employer and experienced that. I have been an employee when I was in college. I remember working for a guy, and it was three of us this one summer. I worked during the summer for this painter. And we had another guy who was a church member. And the painter, you know, I'm a young kid, so I got lots of energy, and I'd show up on time. Even if it was the night after Bible study or the night after Spokesman Club or the night after whatever, I'd show up, you know, 7 o'clock or whatever time I was supposed to be there. And that's what I was always taught, that's how I was supposed to be. And this other guy would come in late or say, you know, I was up late last night because we had Bible study and I mean, you know, I couldn't get up. And you know, he expected this special treatment because we're all in the church and it's okay. And my boss said, you know, I've had all kinds of people that had maybe, you know, a lot of bad habits that would cause them to be late in the morning, but at least they'd show up for work. And even if they were like hungover, they'd show up, you know, show up on time. You know, you got a church member that should have more of a conscience toward, you know, being a good employee, and they want to use our relationship in the church as an excuse not to be good. So I think that's the principle here. And it's saying, you know, don't take advantage. If your master is in the church as an employee or as a servant here, a bond slave, you know, don't take advantage of that. Say, well, you can't tell me what to do. We're in the church, you know, we're even. And in the church, that's what the church did in the New Testament, by the way, is they got rid of the you know, there's no bond, no free, no male, no female. They got rid of the class distinctions. And they greeted one another with a holy kiss, which you wouldn't do in public. You wouldn't kiss a slave. But in the church, they would. I say kiss, you know, the whole, whatever the formal, not formal, but the familial greeting was. You wouldn't do that, but in the church they did. In the church, you know, in society, you wouldn't have a slave who had some official capacity. In the church, you had slaves who were deacons and deaconesses. Okay, so within the community of the church, they got rid of, you know, that was the ideal anyway, and at times they did because we have historical references to it, they got rid of the castes. differences, and the, you know, those differences between people were all one in Christ, and that's the ideal, and that's what they worked toward, and they did do it. Like I said, there are references to that. But just because you did that did not mean you erased the fact that I work for you, and therefore I owe you a good day's work. And it doesn't erase the fact either that a boss needs to be a good boss. Even more so means that we should be good bosses and good employees because we're in the church. Okay, Titus, while we're nearby. Titus chapter 2, we'll look at all of them, won't take long. Verse 9, exhort servants to be obedient to their own masters and to please them well in all things, not answering again, not stealing, but showing good fidelity that they might adorn the doctrine of God, our Savior, in all things. You know, be good employees. Be good employees, be good bosses. Well, most of these are to employees or servants. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 18. 1 Peter 2, verse 18. Servants, be subject to your own masters with all fear, not only to the good and gentle, but to the froward. For this is thankworthy if a man for conscience toward God endures grief, suffering wrongfully. You know, sometimes you work and you have a bad boss, and you have to look past the boss and say, you know, it's my job. I'm under authority. I need to just suck it up, as they say, and do a good job as if I'm working for God. And that's what we do. For this is thankworthy, if a man for conscience toward God endure grief, suffering wrongfully. You know, what glory is it, verse 20 says, when you're buffeted for your faults? Yeah, because, you know, and you take that patiently, but if you don't deserve it and you have to take it, then you've done something. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, which talks a lot about different situations that we find ourselves in the church and what to do about it. We'll look at verse 18, 1 Corinthians 7, verse 18. Is any man called being circumcised? Don't seek to be uncircumcised. If you're uncircumcised, don't seek to be circumcised. Circumcision is nothing. Uncircumcision is nothing. The keeping of the commandments of God. Let every man abide in the same calling wherein he was called. So you don't have to try to change your status in the world because you've been called. That's what his point is. Are you called being a servant? Don't worry about it. But if you can be made free, do that. That's great. But if you're called in the Lord being a servant, you're the Lord's free man. Likewise, also he that is called being free is Christ's servant. I mean, you know, Paul getting into that, being a servant of Christ, that is very much part of his theology. And he says, you are bought with a price. He's talking about all of us, not slaves, but all of us. So don't be the servants of men. But every man, verse 24, wherein he's called, therein abide with God. So you're called in a certain situation, make the most of it and perform your function, your role in a godly way. Colossians chapter 3, these are pretty much all saying the same thing, so I'll just go through them, but I want to at least say that we looked at them all. Colossians chapter 3, verse 22. Servants, obey in all things your masters according to the flesh, not with eye service as men pleasers, but in singleness of heart, fearing God. And whatever you do, do heartily as to the Lord and not unto men. Okay, there's that verse, you know, where you could look past your boss. But then we finally there's some advice given to masters, chapter 4, verse 1. Masters, give unto your servants that which is just and equal, knowing that you also have a master in heaven. You know, be just as Job said back in Job 31. You know, be just and honest and fair with your servants. You know, everybody's got to serve somebody. You know, that's what it says here. You have a master in heaven. Just remember that. You know, none of us are really free. We have a master in heaven. Ephesians chapter 6, next to the last one here. Ephesians 6, verse 5. More of the same, really. Servants, be obedient to them that are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling and singleness of your heart. Notice, by the way, that there's a lot of instruction for servants. Why is that? It just goes to show you that there were a lot of servants there were a lot of slaves in the church. And why is that? Maybe the same reason why there's such interest in places like Haiti or in Kenya or in Nigeria. You know, when you got it rough, to one degree or another, you look beyond that. It's easier, perhaps a little bit easier, to focus on the kingdom when your own life is not very much like the kingdom. Servants, be obedient to them that are your masters. So there's a lot of servants, a lot of slaves. I should say slaves there. In the church, in singleness of heart, you know, work as if you're working for Christ, not with eye servants, but as men pleasers. Same thing we've read before. With goodwill, doing service, verse 7, as to the Lord, not to men, knowing that whatsoever good thing a man does, the same he shall receive of the Lord, whether he's bond or free. Either way, you know, the same rules. And you masters, here we go again, some advice to masters. Do the same things unto them, forbearing, threatening. Don't be a threatener. Don't be, you know, how many people, you know, no show of hands here, but I've worked for people, especially when I had my own business. You had some people that operate on the basis of threat. You know, they've got to threaten you to get you to do something. And I just naturally recoil to that. And I've learned over the long haul that you got to, for most of the time, you have to give it back. If you don't give it back to them, they'll just take advantage of it and you'll roll all over you. But I don't like that. I hate that. I don't like doing it to people. And, you know, and the Bibles are saying, you know, don't do that. Don't be a threatener. You know, just treat them right. Knowing that your master also is in heaven, neither is there respect of persons with him. So that's a beautiful thing. Regardless of where you find yourself in the pecking order in life, God, there's no respect of persons. Within the church, there should be no respect of persons. And give them credit. In the New Testament here, they were getting it done. Was it always perfect? No. James talks about, you know, sitting in the good seats. You know, there were all kinds of abuses of this. Paul gets in with the Passover, you know, or when they had the meal together and so forth. And some were coming early and had much, and others didn't have enough. And so they had their problems. But the idea was, we got rid of all that in the church, and we do have historical evidence that they were getting rid of it in a lot of cases. And people on the outside noticed that, and it was a beautiful thing, and it still needs to be that way. Galatians 3:28, you know, this is a memory scripture. We know what it says. There's neither Jew nor Greek. There's neither bond nor free. There's neither male nor female. You are all one in Christ Jesus. That's the ideal. So there's plenty of instruction to masters and slaves, more instruction to the slaves. The church was a proving ground. The church was a place where they were going to work this new society, because they couldn't do it in society as a whole. Rome's not going to allow that. Rome ran on slave labor. Just like, you know, why do we have the standard of living we have? Well, a lot of hard work, a lot of good inventions, all kinds of blessings from God. But one of the reasons is because of what amounts to slave labor in other parts of the world, or labor at much reduced rates of what we have to pay here. And that's why we can enjoy what we enjoy. So it's kind of always been that way. You know, some people are doing better than others and at the expense of others. And to one degree or another, we're no different now than it was then. But in the church, no. In the church, they ate together. Slaves ate with the masters. You know, they shared the bread and the wine together. They got rid of those barriers. And that's a beautiful thing. The church couldn't change the Roman Empire, but they could model the kingdom in their own fellowship. So, in summary, does the Bible support slavery? I don't think so. That's my strong feeling. The Bible does not support slavery. Does it condone slavery? And I learned, I don't know if I shared this before, but the word condone, the first word, you know, when it comes up, the first meaning of condone is tolerate. Not, I think condone means, I always thought condone meant approve of, but not really. That's just a, that's a further down meaning. Condone means you kind of tolerate it. Does the Bible condone in that sense, tolerate slavery and regulate it? Yeah, I think it's fair to say yes, especially in the Old Testament. Just like war, divorce, polygamy, and revenge. God's desire for mankind should not be deduced, in my opinion, from isolated verses in the Torah that were designed to manage a new society made up of rebellious Israelites that didn't have God's spirit and weren't all that interested in being, you know, righteous. But God, you know, had to put a lid on certain behavior, try to put a, you know, to at least have the laws in place to put a lid on certain negative behavior. And that's what we read. I don't think that means that God approved of the certain practices. It's just that to minimize the damage, we're going to have these rules and regulations and try to keep people from abusing one another. Since Jesus came and the Holy Spirit came, things are different. Now, you know, you turn the other cheek. You carry the coat 2 miles instead of one or whatever. We're held to a higher standard. Slavery is not God's intention from the beginning. It was not so, and it won't be that way in the future.